I think we'll get started. Mine is. If we could turn the rest of the microphones on for the speakers, that'd be great. So welcome to this press conference on the session on the 25th anniversary of HIV and AIDS. I'm Helene Gale, and I'm co-chair of the conference and president of the International AIDS Society. As you know, this conference marks the 25th anniversary of the first reported cases of the disease that later became known as AIDS. Today's special session featured a panel of experts who represent the range of stakeholders in the fight against HIV/AIDS, who reflected on the first 25 years of the global response and how that history can help inform our future actions to accelerate research, scale up prevention, care, and treatment. So we have three of our panelists from this afternoon session. First of all, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health. He discussed the history of the scientific response to HIV and AIDS, and I think most people are well aware that Dr. Fauci has been a stalwart in the fight against HIV/AIDS since the very beginning. Greg Gonsalves of the AIDS and Rights Alliance of South Africa discussed the role of activists over the past 25 years, which includes the fact that he himself has been a activist since the very beginning of the epidemic and has really made incredible contributions to the fight. And then Dr. Elizabeth Madra from the Uganda AIDS program, who spoke from the point of view of a developing country that responded early to HIV and AIDS with a focus on how the lessons learned in Uganda may be applicable to our ability to have an impact on epidemics around the world in the future. So we'll first turn it over to our panelists to just give a very brief recap of some of the key points they made in their presentations this afternoon, and then open it up to questions from you.
Tony. Okay. Thank you, Helene. I'm going to summarize a seven-minute presentation now in a minute and a half to 2 minutes, so we're really getting down there. The points that I made in my brief discussion a little bit earlier was that the scientific advances from the very beginning of the HIV pandemic have really been virtually breathtaking, from the first well-defined and defining and transforming discovery of HIV as the cause of AIDS up through the delineation of the pathogenesis, and then we got to the practical component of blood tests that screened the blood supply and prevented millions and millions of infections, as well as getting a feel for the underlying depth and breadth of the epidemic, the pandemic, and then also the development of drugs, which have totally transformed, at least over the last 10 years, what we and how we treat HIV-infected individuals. Now, those are things that one could celebrate as great success stories. But the point that I made and underscored in my discussion is that the scientific advances such as that are really for naught unless we get them translated and available to those people who are most in need, which is the vast majority of people who are HIV infected. The numbers that I gave of 1.6 million people in the developing world on antiretrovirals, when that's only one quarter, 25% of those who need it. And the other is the issue of prevention. We have to be very open-minded and realize that prevention is not a unidimensional phenomenon where one size fits all in one region or one group of people, that you have to go from everything from condoms to circumcision to needle exchange to education, abstinence in those cases where it's appropriate and workable, as well as ultimately a vaccine. And I ended with a statement which I feel very strongly about, is that as much as I was given the task of summarizing the scientific accomplishments, I feel very strongly that 25 years worth of breathtaking scientific accomplishments are really not what we're going to be judged by history. We're going to be judged by how we utilized and translated those scientific accomplishments to the world that needs it now and for the next 25 years.
Thanks. Greg.
Well, you know, we keep talking about how this is a women's epidemic, And I think men do too much of the talking. So actually, I'd like Tinsley Mavasa and Spum Tati from Treatment Action Campaign to come up and join me here, because I'd like to cede my minute and a half so that Kansani and Sipo could talk for a bit about the developments that are happening in South Africa right now.
Could while they're coming up, Elizabeth, just do your summary, and then we'll get back.
Well, my summary this afternoon basically looked at how the countries in Africa responded to the epidemic in the early 80s when the first cases were reported in some of the African countries. I gave Uganda as an example, is because we responded to the epidemic around 82 when most of the African countries were still deciding whether to open up or not. Finally, I looked at how the leadership eventually caught up and responded positively to the epidemic. Plans were made, strategies were made, decentralization programs, multi-sectoral approach. These approaches help in trying to see decline of HIV in many of the countries. But that did not go for long. Up to today, we are talking about Africa still bearing 70% of the brunt of this epidemic. So what is really happening in Africa that we cannot reduce this epidemic any further? Why is it still Africa being quoted as example of the worst hit country in the world? So we revisited in terms of what should be done, and I say we should no longer use the same strategies in all the countries. Let each of the African countries identify the driving factors of the epidemic, and country-specific factors identified can then be the basis on which strategies can be developed, both for prevention, for care, and treatment. Because I don't think it is anymore the issue of money. It is actually the issue of commitment, the issue of accountability, the issue of putting where the money can work best. Also, the issue of seeing to it that prevention is a priority, care is linked to prevention, and then also addressing all those vulnerable issues which we've been able to talk during the conference here, like the issue of gender equality, the issue of lack of women barrier methods, the issue of addressing sex workers, which is not being looked at as some of the driving factors. And then, of course, antiretroviral being provided should be linked to prevention. And I think that's the only way Africa, again, will realize driving down the epidemic, and we see at least a reduction, especially in new infection, but not only the prevalence.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the time, and we're happy to see a few more media representatives than we saw yesterday at an activist press conference we organized somewhere in a little room at the back. And clearly for the media, activists and people living with HIV issues were not as important as listening to Bill Clinton and Bill and Melinda Gates speak, and we were quite aggrieved by that. And so that is an issue that we'd like to bring to the attention of the media, that this AIDS conference takes place immediately after a United Nations declaration which governments of all across the world adopted. And that declaration was very specific about what needs to be done. And yet this conference has engaged very little with what needs to be done to ensure access to universal treatment, prevention, care, and support for people of the world with AIDS. We are also aggrieved, and we have to appreciate the leadership given by some representatives of the IAS, including Helen Gale and others. But we have to say this to the IAS, that we are quite aggrieved as people of the world, particularly those of us coming from developing countries where HIV and AIDS are the biggest public health crisis, that this conference has been more of a Hollywood conference for philanthropists and for stars than it is a conference where the voices of people living with AIDS and who came here carrying the voices and the pain of people who are sitting back at home dying and whose voices this conference has not even taken into account. So we would like for this to be registered by the IAS, that we are quite aggrieved and we find it unacceptable that people who have had more stronger voice than people with AIDS and then activists coming from the regions most affected by HIV have had a lesser voice than people who are rich and have money. And to that effect, we ask, does money and does having been a former president buy you this, a voice in today's times? We in South Africa, and I want to register this today, heard that a prisoner who had laid a complaint in the courts died yesterday. And that the government of South Africa, and this conference has not even engaged with that, has instead of saying this is how it's going to provide treatment to prisoners, it's appealed a decision by the court, which ordered it last month to execute and implement a plan to provide treatment to prisoners, which is a right according to South Africa's constitution. This has not been heard in this conference, and this conference has not made a statement denouncing the South African government's behavior. Activists from Asia, and particularly China and then Thailand, came here just a couple of months after a group of women who were demanding recourse from the government, where instead of being given recourse and being given care and treatment for having been given blood by the government of China, and therefore infected that way, they were imprisoned. And these are gross human rights violations which happened just a few weeks before the IAEA's organized conference, and this conference has not even condemned those acts. And we therefore want to ask that, particularly to the IAS, that this conference and to should justify its theme, which says it is time to deliver. And the way for it to justify its theme is to actually address the real problems of people of the world who are dying and are waiting for treatment, and are dying waiting for prevention, and are dying waiting for their human rights to be protected and promoted by governments, particularly drug users in Thailand who continue to be criminalized in the same wavelength as drug use. And we ask that this conference should speak to these issues, because if this conference ends without any of those issues having been addressed, then as activists, we have to declare this conference a failure.
Thank you. And I think you raised some very important points, and I would be happy to talk afterwards about some of these issues, that this is some of which are the first time I'm actually hearing about some of those. I would like to have the opportunity to take questions from the media, because this is a press conference, and one of the important roles that the media has is to be able to get some of the issues out there for the rest of the world. So if we could take some questions from the press, and then I would be happy to talk about some of these issues afterwards as well. And we'd be happy to have questions directed at either. We'll be happy. Yeah, and we'll be happy to have questions directed to either the two of you as well. First question.
I thank you.
My name is Laurie Brown. I'm an independent journalist based in Toronto. This is a question for Mr. Gonzalez. Stephen Lewis has called the WTO policies for reducing poverty a failure, which have in fact perpetuated AIDS. I was wondering if you could speak to that, and perhaps also talk...
Before questions, I would like to speak first.
And I address it to all the folks who are at the conference
here. Before questions, I'm asking...
But I want to get Mr. Gonzalez's perspective.
I thank you. I think I'm the right person to speak in this conference, as I'm from one of the developing countries, and as a person who's facing all the things that you're talking about. The first question that I want to ask before I speak is that, is this the AIDS conference or is this the Hollywood conference? Because now we're talking about the things that are happening at the grassroots level, but the people are not here. It's a long time now we've been talking of the epidemic, where the epidemic has hit the hardest, where the things are happening, we're talking about the people who are not here. So my question is, are we here for 24-hour speech, or are we here to talk about the actions? When we follow the theme says it's now time to deliver, it's now time for actions. But what we are talking about here, we are not talking about actions, we are giving speech. So what I want to say is that, where is the GPAC principle? when we are talking about the HIV positive people, where are they? Because only the people who are speaking here are the professionals and all the people who are just thinking of these things, not the people who are having the experience about what is happening when we talk of the epidemic. I thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Anybody else want to respond to the question about the integration of development issues and the need to address those in the context of fighting the epidemic? Elizabeth, maybe you may want to.
I think if I may respond to the issue raised by my sister from Africa, actually the involvement of people living with HIV and AIDS is very, very important.
I'm not sure your mic is on. Is it, you can hear it? Okay.
Oh, sorry.
Speak into it.
Yeah. Closer to my... Can you hear now? Is it okay? What I'm saying is the issue she raised is very pertinent. For us in Uganda, without the involvement of people living with HIV and AIDS, I don't think we would have achieved what we have achieved up to today. And in my presentation, although it was a shorter time, you could see as our elements and the pillars of response, the involvement was much, much earlier because we saw them as partners. And that is the trend which is really to be followed. And also the people living with HIV and AIDS should also show the responsibility of really addressing the epidemic, not to look like as it is a kind of a fight between the people who are addressing this epidemic at the same time. And indeed, where we have to look at is what will be the role of people living with HIV and AIDS in addressing this. The leadership role, it is there. We've involved them even when it comes to the advocacy. They've been also involved as partners carrying out intervention, providing also the services. It is us who now need together to put those strategies in place to address the epidemic in total. What are we doing now? What do we need to do more? What is that we've done and never worked so that we improved each time as we address it? It has come clearly that we look at the prevention. Now, the prevention we look at should not be in that context of only promoting condom use and safer sex. What about the issue of positive living? What about the positive prevention? This is where we see also people living with HIV and AIDS can come and help. What about using antiretroviral treatment as a linkage, as entry point to prevention? This is where also people living with HIV and AIDS can come and help. And then also the support services to the people affected and infected. So I think that is the angle at which we should really look at, and also utilization of the resources equally, both for program interventions to support people living with HIV and AIDS, also to support the impacts. And I think the partnership is what we should really thrive at, but not dividing ourselves. And of course, we shall be supported from our donors, from our development partners, with external funding, which is coming to address the epidemic in totality.
Thank you. We had a question here. Mike? Mike? Yep.
Yeah, good afternoon. Can I ask a question as a journalist who is living with HIV? And I applaud my brothers and sisters, incidentally. But I want to ask Mr. Gonzalez, you've been very strong and quite condemning of this conference in your speech. And you're saying that HIV-positive activists have been excluded from this conference and marginalized. Could you expand on that, please?
I'm going to respond to that if you don't mind, because I can speak on the same issue. I think there are two issues here. One is you can exclude people living with HIV by hiding the issues underneath the grand announcements, which, and we must say this categorically, that we appreciate the commitment being displayed by Mr. Clinton and by Mr. Gelt and the Gates and the leadership they're giving. But that should not be done in a way that replaces and which in fact allows the complacency and inaction of governments of the world in addressing and in finding the solutions of the AIDS epidemic. And that is our line. And so we feel that while there is a lot of issues being addressed at this conference, the real and practical issues being faced by people living with HIV the practical things of second line therapy is inaccessible for many people, and people are therefore sitting there waiting for the mercy of drug companies, whereas governments could act in ways which make it possible for people to get these drugs. So we feel that that is one of the ways in which people living with HIV and their practical experiences have been hidden in this conference. The other issue is, and this is again an issue that we feel we take with the media and with the kind of announcements and publicity and space given to people with power, with money, and with influence, that we feel, yes, at plenary, at the opening ceremony, you had Afrika who represented people living with HIV, but systematically, if you have to analyze the space given to people living with HIV and their issues, it's been very little. So that's how we would like to respond. And we feel that people living with HIV, had they had a stronger voice, they could have raised many of the practical issues and, in fact, guided this conference and along its theme of time to deliver.
Thank you. Other questions? If no, yes, Mike.
I had a question for Dr. Madra, referencing Uganda. If you could comment on what impact the condom shortage had on Uganda's STI and HIV rates, and what impact you think it will have in the future.
The condom, I think, was not being used for prevention in isolation in our strategies in Uganda. We've used the strategies looking at both the abstinency, the faithfulness, and condom use as a three in one. And that was looking at it not in a way it is being perceived today, like completely abstaining. We gave opportunity for those who could not abstain to use the condom. And we gave opportunity for those who may not be faithful also to use the condom. The successes we've made so far cannot be attributed to one item, because there is a section of the group who may have chosen one of the strategies, either to abstain, to be faithful, or to use the condom. But then, of course, you may also know that 90% or 94%, I would say, of the population may not be HIV infected. And those are the people we need also to prevent from picking up infection. And what do we do here is that we need to encourage people to test. And we went on the prevention aspect of providing HIV counseling and testing to individuals who are willing to know their status. And knowing the status is one entry point also to prevention. If you are negative, you are counseled, you are giving all the information on the risk situation, which then, if you do understand very well, you can also prevent getting infection. So it was not only the condom as well. We put that as one of the strategies. We manage our STIs very, very well by providing syndromic management for sexually transmitted cases which appeared at the clinic. We also went community mobilization, information, education, and communication to the masses, which also helped us with the community participation to really talk about this epidemic. And I think that created awareness, it increased on behavioral change, and eventually we saw decline in the prevalence. But now that's not what we are seeing at the moment. So it was not only the condom alone we could assign to. Other intervention for prevention strategies were applied.
We had a question in the back.
Corey Dubin, Committee of 10,000, Coyote Radio. And I'd like to hear from any and all on the panel. We've heard a lot throughout the conference about universal access as a goal, but we have yet to really hear about what the mechanics or the logistics of that may be. We have a situation on the continent where the logistics are problematic, we hear, and we have drug companies with record profits making the AIDS drugs that are so necessary. And I'm interested to hear, as I said, from anybody or all on the panel. Thank you.
Would any of you who are at the country level like to talk about?
Well, at the country level, if I may again chip in here, Helene, is that we need to understand the universal access in various contexts. What is being asked is the sustainability and affordability and availability of the drugs itself. But then we also looked at the infrastructure, which is also providing these services. If we talk of availability of the drugs, what we see currently is just a little reduction in cost of the drugs. But we are not reaching all those who need the treatment. That's true. We are not reaching all those who need the treatment. And at the moment, all countries are declaring free treatment. But then the free is in context. We don't know whether that is going to be sustainable. So we need to look at the issue of sustainability. Many of us have not reached even 50% of those who really need the treatment. And in that case, even at the country level, what should we do? We may have to look at other options. Either have a subsidy program for those who are able to pay even a little fee, go on insurance for employees in the public sector, probably involving also the private sector to contribute, and many of them could also pay for their labor force, the treatment cost, which could go into buying the medication for the poor and the children and women who can't afford. And in that case, we may see the sustainability. Because if we talk now for universal access, when we don't have other options for sustainability, probably that's where we are going to get challenged in the future.
Thank you.
Just to add on the question of targets, I mean, I think I agree with Elizabeth about the issue that it's important that we address questions of sustainability, but I think that to deal with sustainability, governments are going to have to kick some butts, and that's going to mean demanding more of the private sector, who are not coming to the table, particularly at country level, in the way that they could, initiating taxes and such things, because otherwise we're not going to get universal access if we don't, inspire revolutions. The other thing that's going to have to happen is that governments themselves are going to have to show that they're committed to this. Mm-hmm. Because on the question of price of drugs, there is a whole framework now which exists where governments could find even cheaper ways of getting these drugs. But because they are afraid still of drug company, drug company power and influence, they refuse and rather cave into that pressure instead of acting and using their legislative and other power to get cheaper drugs and to borrow technology to manufacture themselves, which is ultimately what this country needs to be doing. And countries like Brazil and India, you know, have got the technology. But countries like Brazil today are sitting and being pressurized despite having, for instance, the technology to produce second-line regimens. And world governments are not, clubbing behind Brazil to say, we want Brazil to use this technology, and we therefore are going to collectively resist the pressure of Abbott, who is standing in the way of Brazil, producing these medicines. The other issue is, I mean, countries have to set targets. They agreed to that. And in setting those targets, yes, they have to look at the local context and local resources, but they also have to be operating with a spirit that says, we either do this or we give up. And I think 25 years into the epidemic, there's no luxury to now sit and say we're going to do half measures. Universal access is the way to go. Otherwise, governments must sit and say we're going to let people die. And this excuse of resources and logistical and infrastructure challenges will not be addressed without the necessary political commitment. Because we've seen in many instances where even in the most remote and difficult places with very little infrastructure, political commitment, which once demonstrates the will to do this, has pushed things and found creative ways of addressing issues. And so that's what I wanted to add to the question.
Thank you.
Well done.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We have a question in the back.
In fact, I'd like to address the question to you, Dr. Gale. It's very clear in the conference that there is a feeling from some of the delegates, especially people living with HIV and AIDS and activists, that we're at a political crossroads, and at the conference, given the nature of this conference as a broad social conference, scientists and activists, is not addressing this enough. You see the same problem occurring with the wonderful UNAIDS position on prevention. It's glorious. I asked Dr. Piot, how can you put forward this position and just say, there it is on the wall, that's it. What about the fact that so many governments in Africa, starting with my own government in South Africa, is still committed to a very conventional version of ABC? Now, I know that you could respond that, well, that's your job as an activist to change your government's position. But isn't that the sense of frustration that you're getting in the conference, that the conference is not taking into account the enormous political obstacles and, in a way, trying to set the tone and set the bar and provide leadership at that level? We're allowing political leaders to get off the hook. That's what I'm getting here. I'd just like to have your response to that.
Yeah, no, I think you raised some very important points. And I think we all as a community need to think more about how do we make our political leaders accountable. I don't think it's simple. You know, if you live in South Africa, you know how tough it's been to make sure that the government of South Africa is really doing what's in the best interest of people at risk, people living with HIV, and really being aggressive about moving things forward. Luckily, you have a very vigorous activist community that really has demanded a lot, and I think has as a result of that, been able to increase the response there. But I think, you know, this is the kind of thing we've all got to figure out. How do we make our leaders accountable? How do we hold all of ourselves accountable for not accepting anything less than what we know we can as a world community pull together to make a difference in this epidemic? And one of the reasons that this theme of time to deliver we feel so strongly about is that we want this to be the conference where we talk about issues of accountability and hold ourselves accountable so that in 2 years when we come back, we actually can talk about successes. We can talk about how we've made some of these things not just rhetoric, but really move them into actions. I think we need all of us to think about how to do that better. And, you know, again, you know how tough this is. This is not something that is just because people lack the will to move their governments forward. So I think we need to think about it. And I think you raise important points. Yes, next question.
Heather Brooks Hill, Herald, Ontario, Canada. Before ARVs, we had very little hope. ARVs created enormous optimism and hope and life. What's in the pipeline, and would you please address viral resistance?
I'll ask Dr. Fauci to address that.
Well, what's in the pipeline are a number of products that we'll likely see either approved or putting up for approval in the relatively near future. Two of which have been discussed at this meeting are integrase inhibitors and maturation inhibitors. The reason it's important when you get a drug that is against a novel target is that it addresses, in many respects, the second part of your question, that there are many people out there who are on the combination of drugs, which are usually nucleoside and non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors with or without a protease inhibitors. And when you get multiple drug resistance to those, one of the solutions to that is to get a new target such as an integrase or a maturation component of the replication cycle or a binding and fusion inhibitor to overcome what will inevitably be the emergence of resistance. So as long as we have good results and we have people, a lot of people on antiretroviral therapy, there will always be the issue of resistance. You can circumvent that a bit by proper attention to the right protocol of treating people and making sure that when people are on drugs, they take them properly as opposed to intermittently, which would perhaps in many cases provide a fertile ground for the development of resistance. So in summary, I believe that the pipeline is relatively robust. We need to not be complacent and make sure we get the drug companies involved and even additional drugs for the pipeline. And the issue of resistance will always be with us, and that's the reason why we've got to be very careful in our guidelines about how we treat people.
We have time for one last question. I'll take a question here.
there's various forms of AIDS denialism, and I'd like to hear from the South African speakers about how that's impacting treatment rollout there, and also from Dr. Fauci about the denialism of the U.S. responsibility to put forth its fair share and holding back the world effort by refusing to lead in putting forth its fair share into the Global Fund and other initiatives.
AIDS denialism in South Africa has taken perhaps some of the most perverse forms. One, and its influence, one is either to deny that there is an AIDS crisis totally, which has been an overarching pattern. Another is to actually say, yes, there's AIDS, and we're going to provide treatment, but we're going to provide choices. And in this case, untested and unscientific choices, as the Minister of Health has done over the years. And that has directly undermined the treatment rollout in that because there's an attitude of denialism, it means that the rollout and treatment isn't being provided at the pace that it needs to be provided. We have nearly a million people in our country who need AIDS treatment today. That prisoner who died yesterday was one of them who got treatment for whom treatment came too late. But we're only providing to just above 230, and 100,000 of those are actually private sector people, which is people buying for themselves. So the government is in fact only providing to just about 130,000 people 3 years after the treatment program was initiated. And even in those 130,000 people, government has had a lot of support by private NGOs and other private program implementers. And South Africa still does not have a target and a plan for how it's going to treat its million people with AIDS today. And so that's one of the things. And I think with the false choice rhetoric that we see all over the place now, even if you go to the South African booth, you'll see garlic and olive oil. And we are actually going now to trash the South African stand. So join us if you want to, because we're sick and tired of government denialism. They're confusing people and denying people, the needed information. And I wanted to add this to Anthony's response about resistance. We're really concerned about the pattern we're seeing with many governments, including that of Botswana, that treatment literacy is not being made a central part of the approach to rollout, and therefore people don't know often how to take these treatments. And we've seen how critical it is and how it can assist when people really know how treatment happens. So we really want to urge that all governments in rolling out have to make treatment literacy, and not just, a little bit of pamphlets, direct and intensive treatment literacy and ongoing treatment literacy for people. And that is the contribution that civil society is prepared to make in coming together in partnership with our governments.
And the last part of that question.
The issue of the commitment of resources on the part of the United States, I think it's important to just look at the facts. And if you look, for example, at the PEPFAR program, whether you agree or disagree or not with certain aspects of emphasis of it, the PEPFAR program has really been very transforming. It's a $15 billion program with an average of about $3 billion a year. And the money has been there. What was promised is there. So I think it would be a bit unfair to say that the United States has not put in a significant amount when it comes to the issues of drugs, drug availability, care, and prevention. With regard to the Global Fund, again, the Global Fund is an interesting concept, because the federal government made a decision that they would focus a considerable amount of their effort on the PEPFAR program, but they still have one-third of the pledges of the Global Fund are from the United States. So I think everyone needs to do better, but I would say, I mean, obviously I'm speaking from someone who is from the United States, but I think in fairness you need to look at the other developed nations and say that, in fact, if they increase their contribution to the Global Fund, that the United States will stay about one-third. So I think everybody needs to do better, but I don't think we should underestimate the impact of the PEPFAR program, which has been substantial.
Right.
No. Of course not. There's no defensible argument for anybody in the world to say that if you have resources that can save lives, particularly of those people who don't have access, that you shouldn't do that. That's just common human decency. In fact, unfortunately, the facts of life, not only with HIV, you could look at a lot of other things. It's just the unfortunate component of our society and how we look at disease burden and death. I mean, human life is worth a lot, and we should be investing more. You'll not get any argument with me about that.
But I want to add that what is perhaps more critical for us to criticize of the U.S. is that it's still driven by drug company interests and promotes drug company interests. We want to see the U.S. starting to show its true commitment by actually pressurizing companies such as Abbott and others who are now doing new research to actually address the bigger problem of patents. And then we can talk about U.S. commitment.
I agree with you completely on that, but also I think we should remember when PEPFAR first came out, the FDA said that they would hasten the approval of generic drugs that can be used with United States money to buy generic drugs for PEPFAR, and there was a great deal of skepticism that they would actually come through with that. There have now been 24 generic drugs that have been approved by the FDA. So we're not where we want to be, but they're going in the right direction.
Thank you all.